For the first time, biologists say they've been able to track individual songbirds on a full round trip from their breeding grounds in North America down to their winter haunts in Latin America and back again. NPR's Richard Harris explains how they did it.
Ornithologist Bridget Stutchbury fell in love with North American songbirds many years ago and has made a career of trying to understand how they manage their incredible voyages.
I've always been frustrated that they leave in the fall and disappear and then, as if by magic, show up in the spring, and we really have no idea where individuals go.
The biologist at York University in Toronto says it's possible to track really hefty birds.
Satellite transmitters have been used for larger birds like peregrine falcons. But those devices are way too big. They're almost the size of a songbird. They wouldn't go anywhere if you put one on their back.
So instead, she turned to a tiny gizmo that was invented by researchers at the British Antarctic Survey called a geolocator. It's half the weight of a dime.
These devices measure light. So you put them on the bird's back as a little backpack, and off the bird goes on migration. And when it comes back the next spring, you catch the bird, take the backpack off, and download the data onto your computer.
The computer can analyze a daily record of sunrise and sunset these birds experience during their migration and get at least some idea of where the birds have been, plus or minus a couple hundred miles. And Stutchbury and her colleagues now report in Science magazine it really works. They managed to track 5 wood thrushes from Pennsylvania to Central America and back. They also followed the flight of 2 purple martins, a type of swallow.
I was surprised that both of them spent most of the winter in the Amazon basin.
Up north, martins usually fly over wide-open fields, catching insects on the wing. But in winter, for some reason, they seem to head for the woods. Even more surprising was how fast one of those martins hightailed it back from the Amazon.
It flew back to its breeding colony in the northern U.S. in only 13 days. This is incredible. I had no idea that songbirds could go this fast.
Also surprising was the flight path of one of the wood thrushes she tracked. Ornithologists assumed that these birds fly straight home from Latin America, right across the Gulf. 4 of them did, but the 5th bird she followed actually took the long way around, flying up the coast of Mexico.
Presumably, this bird was in poor condition, and flying across the Gulf of Mexico usually requires a 12 or 14-hour non-stop flight over water. And if the birds run out of steam over the Gulf of Mexico and go in the water, they're doomed. They're going to die.
Now, this first successful experiment with songbird backpacks isn't simply a matter of curiosity. Stutchbury and other ornithologists are trying to figure out why some species of North American songbirds are in distress. Is it trouble here on their breeding grounds or trouble down south? Pete Mara at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center says these tracking devices could help them solve that mystery.
I actually think that the floodgates are open now, and I think a lot of people are going to be deploying these on as many species as they possibly can. I'm going to put on about 100 on wood thrushes this year across their entire range.
That could provide a clue about why one of the most melodious denizens of the northern woods is slowly fading away. Richard Harris, NPR News.
One animal that, so far as we know, has not appeared on Nigella's menu yet is the latest subject of our series, Sounds Wild. Student zoologist Sarah Benson Amram from Michigan State University lived in a tent in Kenya for 2 years studying spotted hyenas. And she tells Morning Edition how she recorded their sounds.
I had been driving around for a couple hours just looking for different hyenas. And it was near a river. The hyena was actually hidden in a hole in the ground, whooping pretty... It was a pretty distressed-sounding whoop. Her name is Pan, one of the top-ranking hyenas in our study clan. She had on her shoulder a lion paw scratch marks. There was also a carcass around 300 meters from this scene, so my guess is that they had had an interaction with lions earlier that morning that I hadn't seen and that they had gotten pretty beat up. Spotted hyenas are really interesting. They live in social groups called clans of up to 90 individuals, and it's a female-dominated society. Spotted hyenas in particular are often called laughing hyenas, because of this vocalization, the giggle. And it actually has nothing to do with hyenas having a good time. In fact, they're usually pretty stressed out. Often they giggle when they've been attacked. You'll often have just a whole mess of hyenas trying to get access to a carcass. So you'll have one hyena biting another. And when that happens, the hyena that's been bitten will often giggle. So you hear a lot of giggles at carcasses. I love them. They just have personality. You know, there are some that are just really aggressive. There are some that are more playful. Some that are really curious. It's like a soap opera. You follow their lives and you get really involved.
Thanks to NPR science correspondent Christopher Joyce and the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for tracking down these sounds. And you can hear more of them at NPR.org.
President Obama and other proponents of the stimulus package have been selling the spending as one way to move America toward a greener future. They point to tax incentives and investment meant to spur energy savings and green jobs. But the provisions in the stimulus package are not all environmentally friendly. In fact, critics say many parts of the package will encourage dependence on foreign oil and increase the kind of pollution that causes global warming. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that's because the basic notion of a stimulus package is biased toward the status quo.
Some of the money from the stimulus package might be spent right here. We're in suburban Maryland, about 15 miles from Washington, D.C., on the shoulder of I-95. Local officials want to use some of the stimulus money to connect this 8-lane highway with a new toll road that's under construction, called the Intercounty Connector.
So the road will cross over here, and then we'll have a massive cloverleaf interchange.
Michael Replogle is Environmental Defense Fund's transportation director.
This will then be a 12-lane highway, and in some places where there are on-ramps and off-ramps, it'll be 14 lanes wide.
Replogle raises the window in his light green Prius to muffle the roar of the traffic. He says expanding I-95 will mean more cars, more development, and more greenhouse gas pollution. He says Congress should not spend about $29 billion of the stimulus money on highways and bridges, especially not to build new ones.
It's not the kind of investment we need to be making in the 21st century, particularly when we have good leadership at the state and the federal level that is calling on us to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, to get serious about the severe climate change challenge that's ahead of us.
In developing the stimulus package, Shovel Ready was absolutely important.
Carol Browner is director of the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change. She says the primary goal of the stimulus package is to spend money fast to get the economy going. These road projects are ready to go.
The infrastructure, as we all know, across our country is in serious need of attention. We can create jobs immediately through these projects.
Browner says lots of green projects also meet the shovel-ready requirement. So the stimulus spends billions of dollars to weatherize homes, make schools and federal buildings more energy efficient, and stimulate development of wind and solar energy.
The good news is that there were tremendous opportunities in terms of clean energy and green jobs.
I think there are a lot of missed opportunities.
Charles Ebinger heads the Energy Security Initiative for the Brookings Institution, a Washington, D.C. think tank. He says Congress and the president are thinking too small. To spend such a massive amount of money, they should take their time and use it in big, consequential ways to create the foundations of a greener economy.
It may take a lot of political heat. It may take more pain in the interim. We may see much higher levels of unemployment. But if the long run is to make us more efficient and really transition us to the future, this is the way we need to go.
Instead, the money could turn the country's three aging electric grids into one integrated modern one, ready to access new wind farms in the center of the country and solar plants in the southwest. It could fund big green public transportation projects and entice businesses to mass market cars that go 60 miles per gallon.
So I think it's very tragic, and I understand the politics behind getting something out fast. But when we're thinking about something so critical to our future, something President Obama talked about, transformative technology for the future, this is not transformative technology.
Ian Bowles says that's too much to ask of a stimulus package. He's the Energy and Environment Secretary of Massachusetts, and he's hoping to use stimulus money to build wind turbines to power wastewater treatment plants and pay for other clean energy projects.
What it really importantly does is allows us to access an existing pipeline of projects that we don't have the funding to cover, and that'll create jobs and it'll advance both our energy and environmental objectives up here.
Bowles hopes Congress attached enough green strings to prevent states from spending stimulus money on projects that would make it harder to fight climate change and reduce dependence on foreign oil. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.